Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. AJ, how are you, brother?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on, bro.
Oh, mate, it's my pleasure. You've been very kind to host me twice now. And my gosh, yes, I'm hoping to become a better man at the end of this chat with your super skills.
Man, that's awesome. It was a pleasure to have you on, mate. The feedback I actually got for our episode is actually really, really good. I've had a few people message me even from the last episode, and that, like, I'd never heard about you before, so it was great. So hopefully you got a few more followers out of it.
Mate, it's all a bit weird, if I was honest. Sorry, I'm flipping the bloody spotlight onto me, aren't I? But it's maybe a point we can talk about. It's funny how many people's lives you can touch through this sort of medium. Mm-hmm. And just being yourself, and that's all I ever try to be, really. But it's when you hear stuff put back at you like that, that it's, I'm just gonna say, it's weird. I don't know what, like, you know, how to make of it all, really.
It's a good weird.
Yeah, it is. You know, there seems to be a lot of us now that are just trying to put good stuff out there. Yeah. Do you think, like, I'm talking definitely now about my parents' generation, and no disrespect to them, you know, everyone does their best in life, right? Is all you can do. But that post-war sort of era, there was a lot of, let's just say it how it is, there's prejudice, there was superstition, there was societal kind of norms, you know, working class culture, middle class, upper class. It was like a real definite thing. And there was a lot of, like, barriers in place. In fact, just to give a short, sharp example, when I got over all my issues, one of the biggest thing I had to do was just forgive and accept everything that had gone in the past. And the reason I kind of got to that is, like, talking to my parents, I could see they just weren't ready to talk about anything that you and I would call, like, grassroots, mm-hmm. important shit, stuff kids need to know, mm-hmm. stuff adults need to know. You know, we've got so many people not happy at the moment, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And a big leap forward in my own development was realizing, hang on, they've just had all their shit, that generation. You know, they've had this, they deal with it the way that they can. And the way very often was to be like, oh, we don't talk about that, you know, that, I mean, just drugs, for example. Whoa, oh, hang on, that's all bad. Let's just, like, not talk about that at all. And then you get guys like us, AJ, and we're coming out, and we're just trying to do our best, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, not saying that people weren't authentic and stuff like that, but I think a lot of back in the, I guess back then, for example, and even still now, people just rather forget about things and pretend they never happened and stuff like that, and not accept things and actually, like, say, well, actually, you know, to avoid that happening again, what can we do to mitigate things like that, or lessons learned, sort of thing. A lot more people are a lot better at it now. I think the digital age we live in gives people the ability to be able to do a little bit of research, for example, or just instantly be able to speak to somebody about something if they really need to. But I think, I know what you're saying, and I speak to my dad often about when he was a kid growing up, and obviously with my grandfather being so heavily involved in D-Day and all the aftermath of that, you know, what life was like then when he grew up. And even as a kid, if you had a problem or whatever, you just got on with it. That's why there's still so many people now of that generation, you know, my parents' age, your parents' age, stuff like that, turn their nose up at how like people communicate, and or I guess how easy people can complain is what that, you know, usually a subject of top conversation with a lot of people that kind of age, and it puts them off, you know, wanting to be on social media or stuff like that, or, you know, having that kind of taking up their headspace sort of thing, because we do live in a much more sort of victim mentality world now, you know, compared to my dad was a kid, for example, or, you know, obviously I wasn't alive then, but you know, it's all plain to see that we clearly do now more than ever. And I think everything that's going on at the minute, especially, you know, the start of this new year, everything's going on in our country, in the UK, people are extremely frustrated and angry, and I wouldn't say just kicking off, but like, it's just people are voicing a lot of frustrations and issues and pain points more than ever, you know. I guess some people are finding more time on their hands because of like what the restrictions are, but you know, nonetheless, I think, yeah, it's a very strange time we live in terms of things like that. And I you know, I often watch movies, war movies and stuff like that, and I know it's only a movie, but you see sort of like the people out in the streets just playing, people just stood there talking to each other, you know, like it just looked like such simpler times. And when I went to Sierra Leone this time last year, you know, I just sat there watching kids, for example, just playing with like random sticks and like old tires and stuff like stuff we used to do as kids, because, you know, we didn't have mobile phones and you know, Xboxes and all the rest of it. And I was just sat there just watching it, just like, it really made me miss my childhood and the simpler times and that. And you just look at me like, well, that's all they got, and they make the most of it. No questions asked.
I was trying to explain to my son, I mean, you've been in Sierra Leone, which is West Africa. I've been down there in Mozambique, East Africa. When I talk to kids there, right, the biggest toy they had, or the only toy, was a football, and it was made from a carrier bag wrapped around itself.
Oh, no.
Then they got another carrier bag and wrapped it around that, until you got this hoofing great puffball carrier bag thingy that actually had quite some weight to it. So it was, you know, not on the level of a real football, obviously.
Yeah, I've seen a few of those.
I was just trying to explain to my son that, you know, Christmas isn't just about, in we can say this freely, like plastic crap.
Mm-hmm.
That's all going to go into landfill in less than a year's time. It's just, it's hard to get away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and we were very rigid with this because me and my wife have got very similar beliefs with all this kind of stuff. We're very much about experiences rather than material items. I think if you've like done well in life and, you know, you've got the money to do it, you know, there's nothing wrong at all, I don't think, with buying yourself a nice watch, having a nice car, like all this kind of stuff. For a lot of people, it's, you know, good material anchors to show where they've come from, to, you know, and that's what helps drives them every day to and helps them to acknowledge like where they've come from as well. But, you know, we've been very quick when the kids were a bit younger, they're older now, but we were very, very quick to say, like, we're not buying you plastic cheap toys for Christmas, or, you know, that just break or sit in the back of the cupboard till next year, often in their wrappers and that, because that's what happens. Almost comes a competition at Christmas time, doesn't it, where people are like, oh, we need to buy our kids as much as possible. We have to get this now. We need this. They need this. When if you actually accumulate all the money that you end up spending on something, like, you could actually get your children a real life experience in something that actually changes the way they might perceive things. So instead of spending loads of money on plastic toys or this or that or the other, that's just only going to confine them to their room even more, because that's where they need to play with these new toys. You can spend the same amount of money on something that's outside, that's an experience that's, you know, potentially going to help bring out something in them that's going to help them in the future, you know. So like when I lived in Australia, we didn't buy the kids toys and stuff. We bought them like little kayaks and bodyboards and that. And then we were actually like, well, we need to use these. So to use them, we've got to go to the beach. And then when you're at the beach, you're outside in the sun, the sand, you know, and everything else that comes with that. And it's, you know, the same this year. You know, like, well, we bought my son like driving experiences. We've brought my daughter like feeding giraffes live at, you know, properly, you know, just all that kind of stuff, because she wants to get into some kind of like animal, like biology type stuff when she's older, you know. So that, you know, that's just us, you know. Not everyone has to, you know, do that. I get that, but and, you know, and each to their own. But I think the more experience you give your kids and or you do, you know, your teenagers or even in adulthood at an early age, I think it really helps shape their future. So, you know, my kids have lived in England, Germany, you know, from being in the forces, and Australia, and it's, you know, that experience for them at such a young age has helped shape them. Like now, you know, right now they're already day one of the school's not going back and having to work from home. Their frustrations are showing because they're having to work from home, but they're both top sets in their subjects like maths, English and science, but there's only one teacher teaching and they have to, you know, do for the whole year group. So they're having to learn bottom tier stuff. So that's a credit to them, you know, being in the top sets all the time, because they gain that mentality of, you know, wanting to do better all the time, because they can see what that brings by, you know, or what success in those areas will bring you. Gives the opportunity to travel, gives you the opportunity to do all these things, because they've experienced it, they've seen those cultures, you know.
Yes, massively. I'm conscious here that we're here to talk about your story, AJ, so I just wanted to chip in and say my son got a bushcraft knife for Christmas. He's 5 years old, and people went to me, "You gave him a bushcraft knife at five?" I said, "No, I gave him a pen knife at one." And it's literally there. The bushcraft knife is next to it, and his uncle bought him a multi-tool, right?
Mm.
He can wield an axe now at 5 years old, completely safe. He knows how to keep his legs back. You know, the other day, it was quite a poignant moment, AJ. He shifted his toy toolkit. You know, he had one of these like little tool centers or whatever that kids have, and a little box of tools. And he went, "That can go in the roof now, mummy." So, but yes, back to your story, mate. What, you joined the army?
Yeah.
Because the alternative was prison. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. So I was an army brat, like many people I served with. There was actually many people I went to school with that joined as well. You know, usually you become a product of your own environment, don't you? So I went to school in Germany, a British school, and thoroughly enjoyed it. I got a really good education and did really well, got good grades at school. I'm one of those annoying people that just seems to soak up information. So like when it comes to revision and stuff like that, I didn't really do any. I was just playing football nonstop. I ended up still getting good results. And because I was so heavily focused on football, that was the be all and end all for me. And I went to AFC Bournemouth after school because they come and watch me play. And then I went for a trial and then they said they were really keen to sign me. So I signed for them straight from leaving school. And then I went to play with them and went to college on the youth training scheme. But then I got injured and it was actually like...
AJ, can we just clarify for our American friends? So you're a professional footballer, basically.
Yeah, training. Yeah, in the youth team of a professional club. Yes.
Yeah.
So
which is like a massive dream for anyone that likes football, is to get signed by a proper club.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's all I wanted to do. So So I injured my knee. I like severed a nerve like on the outside of my left leg. And it was actually having like just a kickabout on a Sunday evening with some friends and one of my cousins. And I couldn't feel anything properly in my like my big toe and the toe next to it for like a good few months. And the club back then wasn't like as rich as it is now. I didn't have to sort of like the medical facilities and stuff like that. So on like a youth player that's, you know, they come and go, they do, you know, that's just the reality of it. It's quite cutthroat. They released me and that was my dream just shattered, and it literally knocked me for six. I didn't have a clue what I was supposed to do, where I was supposed to go. My mum and dad were still living in Germany, so I was living under my nan and granddad, so I was like living away from home. I was just like, had no idea what I wanted to do and stuff like that. And then just started getting involved in the wrong crowds, you know, just hanging around with people in pubs and then getting more friendly with them. And You know, next thing it's like house parties, and then it's like smoking weed, and then it's, you know, one thing to another, it's like harder drugs. And then I'm hanging, you know, fully in with these groups of people. And we start got involved with like low level sort of like crime and fraud and stuff like that. And just got greedy and got caught. And, but I mean, my saving grace was that I was, but at that point I got caught and arrested. I was actually questioning everything I wanted to do in life anyway. And like, you know, this isn't my future, and fully acknowledging that. And the day before that, I went into the careers office in Bournemouth and ended up signing up to join the army. Another funny turn of events was I actually walked into the careers office because I wanted to get out of the rain because it was pissing it down. So it's funny how things work out. And yeah, so I went in there with like, you know, puffed out chest, like, you know, I think I'm made for this. This is going to get me away from all the shit that I'm doing now. I don't see any future of, you know, what I'm doing. And had every intention of joining the paras. That's what I wanted to do. But I walked out of there, big smile on my face, and then I got arrested the next day. Went to court very quickly. The two other lads that was sentenced with me, they ended up going to prison. And, you know, we were clearly guilty of what we'd done. We just got greedy, got caught out. And but then the judge said, look, you know, the solicitor said that, you know, Mr. Roberts is joining, you know, the army, he's applied to join the army. He's got, you know, his stepfather's in the army. He's got this background, blah, blah, blah. And the judge said, look, you follow it through. And if it's not followed through within X amount of time, I can't remember what he said, you're going to be joining your friends basically in a cell. And that was literally a saving grace. You join the army or go to prison. Bit of a no-brainer. Yeah, and then I ended up, you know, going through the motions of selection and stuff like that. And it wasn't until after selection, my stepdad was just like, if you join the paras with those grades that you've got, I'm going to kick your head in. So I didn't end up joining the paras, I ended up joining the Royal Engineers. And, you know, to get a trade and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, something to fall back on, as they say, when you get out.
Can we just analyze that a bit, mate? Because, and I've got no dog in this fight. I'm too old to really give a shit, to be honest. But you do meet a lot of people over the years whose old man went, no, you're not joining the Marines. You're not joining the paras. You need to get a trade. And in fairness, I remember when I was struggling after leaving the Corps, and my mate Rob, hello, Rob, if you ever get to watch this, he was Royal Engineers, and he just left and started driving cranes. And he's getting, you know, 500 quid a week to drive a crane. Well, I was unemployed and skint, couldn't see any future. Certainly, I wasn't qualified for it as a Marine, you know. Security guard, maybe. I wasn't a... Oh, one sec, mate. So, yeah, so yeah, there's my mate who joined the engineers, and it came good for him. You know, he got a job driving cranes, and there's me, I couldn't get a job doing anything. So what I will say in hindsight is I am sort of glad I joined the Marine. I shouldn't say this to an engineer, maybe.
No, I totally agree. And it's just, but you know, it's everything. Yeah, hindsight is obviously beautiful, isn't it? And, you know, I look back and I spent 2 years of my career at Chatham in Kent doing trade courses and that, like, for something I never, ever touched. So, you know, it doesn't mean I think you've got to have the intention of actually going, yeah, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this and follow and actually using it, following through. But the units I went to just never gave me there was no need for the trade because I did like refrigeration and air conditioning. And if you said to me, you know, I remember getting to a unit and the only time, there was even mention of using my trade was someone saying to me, can you go and have a look at the fridges in the officer's mess because all the alcohol's warm. That was it. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I was literally just on, like most lads, just on the town most nights. You know, you just kind of turn up, didn't you? Soak it all in. And I've never used my trade at all in the military. And I guess the only really transferable stuff that I use today, yeah, from the military stuff, is actually being on operations, doing like real shit, like doing army stuff. you know, those experiences where you need to take a, you know, like command and control, take a step back, like assess situations under high pressure and all that kind of stuff. And actually, you know, being in them environments is, you know, like you do, I think helps shape you a hell of a lot more than any like trade courses you do and stuff like that. Because I had no intention, like when I left the army, to go on to be like a refrigeration or air conditioning technician. It was just the process you follow in the military at the time. You know, you go do a trade course.
Yeah, and also it should be mentioned that you saw a hell of a lot more action than I probably did. You know, talking in a combat theater here.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I went to Iraq, it was like quiet-ish. There was still a lot going on. It was on the early telics. And then Afghan was, it was pretty hairy, to be honest. But I think I probably, on my tour, I probably had the best, because I was a corporal, a commander when on my last Afghan tour. And I probably had probably one of the best tours of any of the other corporals in the unit, really, because I wasn't just staying with like my guys all the time. I was getting like drafted out and pulled, and I was getting attached to like SF and just, you know, on my own with like one sapper I'd be bringing with me, you know, attached to Laz and Paul, like attached to BRF, you know, like all types of people. It was really great because there was calls to come through saying they need these people. So, you know, that, and this goes to show you what the importance, I think, of like trying to keep your A game up all the time, especially when you're in the military, because I think in regular units, there's a lot of scope for, especially nowadays, and what I've seen, a lot of people are quite happy to just, you know, like plod along, if you know what I mean. And they're not in the army anymore. It's just literally like 9 to 5 wearing a uniform. I use an example, right? When the redundancies started happening, I think it was the second tranche happened, and it was whilst I was actually in Afghan, my staff sergeant applied for it. And we used to take the mick out of him and stuff out of having like core coloured garden table and stuff like this, you know, from when we were sat around his house at barbecues. But in reality, even though he applied for redundancy and that, like financially, it was the best thing for him, you know, and it was just doing a full blown operational tour, which was quite stressful and kinetic and stuff like that. And I was kind of like, well, good on you. You know what I mean? You've done all this stuff in your career. You've done Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghan. What's the big deal when maybe cutting it short a couple of years early and still being financially better off? You know, you've done soldiering, you've done what you wanted to do out of it all. And like those people, those staff sergeants, those warrant officers and stuff like that at that period, like they were in the army, you know, they had core coloured garden tables. They had like, you know, fucking every engineer builds his own bar. They had all that stuff. Whereas like now people in the same rank stuff out, like don't have any of that. You know, most of them don't even have army pictures in their toilets. You know, it's, again, the stuff that we like take the mick out of back then, but that, like people now just don't, they're not in the army anymore. And I know it's not their fault. A lot of them, they're not on operational tours. You know, there's no like real active raw stuff going on where blokes, you know, guys and girls are getting real sort of theater experience and the stuff that like can shape you so well in other areas of your life. You know, it's helped shape me. It's helped me make the business I've made because I have that experience and being able to create those levels of mindset, which I can teach people, you know, that you don't get on TV Street. You know, the operational stuff is a massive blessing to so many people if you let it.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to know how do you transfer that to what you teach now then? What are some sort of grassroots philosophies or strategies?
I think the ability to be able to stand back and assess a situation and actually be curious and open-minded about stuff, like, and question everything. I think more now than ever, like, you know, with everything going on, there's two very different sides, isn't there, right, to what's going on. You're either pro or against, like, however the government are doing stuff, right? You know, it's there in plain sight to see for everybody. I think military people especially are questioning a lot more stuff because that's what we all do in the military. Like, do you know when like you're told by your corporal commander, whatever, that, you know, right, we're going here, we're going to do this, and this is what we're going to do. The first thing you ask is why? isn't it? Like everyone does. It's like the first thing you do, you ask why. Why are we doing this? Like, what is the purpose? What is the need? Do we really need to do it? And military people are very, very good and astute at doing that. And I think, you know, I'm seeing it like every day now, more and more every day with everything that's going on.
I'll just chip in there, Adrian, and say, let's not mention any of the.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. It just makes everyone knows what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's don't worry. I won't use the dreaded words, but
what I'm finding is, I don't know if it's a divide or whether that's just in my head, but there seems to be the old boys, if we can call them that, they just fucking believe all the shit they see on TV, don't they?
Mm. But it depends what your actual outlets of media are. So if your only outlet is like a few vets groups on Facebook and a few old boys that you've added and stuff like that, which is what many of them do, and then you watch the news three times a day, you're going to form a particular opinion, just like the elderly, which is why hundreds and thousands of them are very scared and, you know, locked up in their houses because they don't want to go anywhere because they think they're going to, you know, they think they're at massively high risk. And, you know, they do unfortunately fall into the same category because you are and you become what you put in your head. You know, it's as simple as that. The younger people, the people are more curious and open-minded, as I mentioned before. I think they're two very important words to describe people you are or you aren't. I think the more curious you become, the much better life you'll have. You know, and that, like when I went to Sierra Leone, for example, I went there very curious about everything, and it just had a huge impact on me and had a massive impact on the people that I met. But the people, like you say, who their only outlet to anything or information is Karen on Facebook and the news, you're only going to get one side of a story like at all. And I think this weekend has proved with the sheer amount of so-called specialists that have been caught out actively lying to the media, and crisis actors like on Sky News that have been caught out, and Radio 5. I just think goes to show that, you know, not everything's as privy as rosy as what people make out, or one-sided.
I think we should shush there just because it's... No, everything you say, mate, is so valid. It's just that I've been saying this for 20 years, right? And now I'm seeing some of the people, and this is no like sour grapes because I don't really care, to be honest, but I'm seeing some of the people that used to poo-poo me because I dared suggest that, you know, you read something like Project for New American Century before you make your summary on what happened in the Middle East and the what's the paper that they wrote, Rebuilding America's Defenses. I'm just highlighting two things there that clearly show what you see in the media is not the reality. And I guess a lot of people are coming head to head with that now, but it depends what the tools are at your disposal, doesn't it? If you're an old school guy that just watches your BBC, you ain't got a clue about the counter shit that's going on. The investments involved, the players, corporate crime, for want of a better word. And then you got young people coming up that have maybe, you know, honed their teeth on, I was going to say the Joe Rogan show, but that's kind of not the same show it was in honesty when I started watching it. You know, it was a very open show. In the earlier days, I should say. It's gone on for 10 years now. But you got young people, they've got social media at their disposal. So whether they like it or not, they're subjected to these alternative views.
Mm.
And I guess it's only a matter of time before you've heard so many different alternatives that don't agree with the mainstream that you've got to go, maybe there is something going on here.
I think a lot of it has to do with a lot of people's traits. You know, some people just are so blasé to everything. You know, they just literally just kind of go, okay, yeah, whatever. I'm trying not to listen to too much of it because it's all negative, blah, blah. And they literally shut everything off. I think that's all very well and good. However, you've got to be quite careful with like that. And I had this conversation with my son's girlfriend's mum about this morning, just because that's what they've been doing, because they've had their own issues like to deal with, you know, putting food on the tables with one. But when it comes to later on down in the line, as in what people have to do or whether people have to lock down, you know, and all this kind of stuff, I think there's got to be times where people actually question, like, why am I actually having to do this? And then that's what triggers people to doing their own research and stuff like that. But, you know, it is very confusing. There is so much stuff out there. There is so much noise. So, you know, like anything in life, I think if you want to do well at something, and I'm including this as in do well in terms of finding what is the right information that serves you, you need to surround yourself with the people who are very, very knowledgeable, have backgrounds and this, that, and the other. So, you know, like this instance, there are people that are screaming from the rooftops who are super qualified, have amazing backgrounds, who are sharing the correct data, the correct information, you know, on a daily basis, and it's growing massively. I'm actually quite interested personally to see what the next 2 weeks hold up, because it's growing that quickly to a point where I don't think it can be drowned out for too much longer. I've got Emma Kenny on my show tomorrow from this morning show.
What's their name?
Emma Kenny. She's from this morning show. She's just done a brilliant YouTube video about the impact this whole thing's having on children, her kids. And, you know, she's so active in wanting to protect kids' mental health as much as possible. So she's using her stature for that in the right manner, which is brilliant. And I'm looking forward to actually sitting down and having a proper full-blown conversation about this all with her tomorrow on my show. It comes out on Wednesday. Yeah, she's very vocal about it all on Twitter and YouTube.
The thing is, though, right, you can peel all this back to a much simpler layer than the obfuscation that's going on in the bloody media. And you must have seen Jurassic Park, right? I think everyone's seen Jurassic Park. There's a classic line in it where what's the scientist's name? Jeff Goldblum, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And he's looking at the old fella played by, mate, your memory's better than mine.
It's Attenborough.
Yes. Sorry. Was it Richard and David? Was it Richard?
Yeah, it's Richard. Yeah, Richard Attenborough, yeah.
And his character's going, yes, look, we've got this great park. We've got these fences. It's all controlled. And the Jeff Goldblum character just looks at him and says, life will find the way. Life will find the way. All right. Okay. Don't quote me on it, but it's something like that. And it, to me, just the stupid notion that anything that crops up in life, we don't even have to say the word, that you can control it by it's just so ridiculously facile that it's juvenile to the point of non-thinking. You know, people have to die. It's called life. And if you get old and you haven't, let's be honest, looked after yourself, and that's no slight on anyone. Some people don't know how to look after themselves. Some people were indoctrinated by their parents' generation. Some people don't care. They want to bloody drink 20 beers a day, right? You know, but it's going to come to you. We are all going to die.
Yeah, absolutely.
We are all going to die. And if it happened to somebody that I love, what would I say? I'd say, we're all going to die. Sorry, you know, I live in the real world.
And that's the problem. Like, I've got people in my own family are doing it. They're like so hell-bent on spending each day dying. They're not living, if that makes sense, because they're locking themselves away as a healthy person under the idea that they could be walking around with, you know, some kind of infection. And that's what's happened on the masses. People have been brainwashed into thinking they're walking, physically walking around with an infection. Just like it's been out over the last, well, since Christmas, this new variant is highly contagious in children when there's no science whatsoever that backs it up. And they're doing it at a time when they're mass testing in schools with a test that is so inaccurate, it's just criminal to use in the first place, which is going to drive the numbers up, which again, I think it's just, the whole thing is just criminal how they can say that children are more more contagious. And I'm glad that top medical professionals and top medical governing bodies have come out this weekend and said that it is totally inaccurate, especially against that idiot that came on Radio 5 Live and said that like the whole children's ward's absolutely full with patients and stuff like that. And you know, she didn't even apologize for lying. And that's the problem that people are facing, you know. And no wonder so many people are scared and worried and confused. You know, my dad's one of them. He just doesn't know what to believe.
People get to a certain age where if they've been in that system, you know, the matrix long enough, there's nothing you can say, right? They believe it. They genuinely, and it gets hard. You know, you see a post on social media, so-and-so died the other day, 44 or 46 or 48, no underlying can. Well, it's like, I get it. That isn't nice that anyone dies, right? Although we all have to. What do you mean by no underlying conditions? How do you know? You know, it's just an easy thing to say.
Yeah, of course it is, yeah.
In the media to belittle the people that have a perspective like us, right? There's no, like, first thing I check on anyone health-wise, are you alkaline, right? What shit are you putting in your body? Are you running on acid all day long? Because if you are, you're going to get sick, son. I don't care who you are. You're going to get sick.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many variables. And then, of course, there's the fact that the ways of detecting these means don't seem to work. I'm laughing at the ludicrousness of it all. Not of people dying, obviously.
It's happening all over the world at the minute. There's in Germany, there's like a massive class action already building up now against the government for crushing loads of businesses based off false numbers of a test that is massively inaccurate, that doesn't actually test for it alone. It's you could have a little sniffle and it's you're told not positive, make positive, positive. That's what's skyrocketing all the numbers. The British Medical Journal just literally brought an article out which they outright say that they thoroughly suggest not to use mass testing on a population that is healthy and asymptomatic, because asymptomatic people, again, this has been just been brought out, asymptomatic people do not transmit it. So you're mass testing a population of healthy people using a test which doesn't test purely for that outside a clinical environment, which is just going to give you a huge number of false positives, which we're then going to use to make the decisions of what we do as a whole country.
Mate, let's break from it there, because I think your story is far more inspiring than what's going on at the minute. AJ, just bear with us one sec. So AJ, tell us about your combat experience. Just, you know, be ashamed to have you on the podcast and not ask.
I get the majority of it is obviously more Afghan based, and it was being attached to people, I think, that got the most of it. Doing explosive entry into compounds, you know, rushing through with the people I was attached to, whether that was sort of pool or BRF or, you know, infantry units. It was brilliant. It was like doing proper soldiering, you know. But then on the flip side of that, you know, even being in the engineers, it's quite strange, really, because you could go with like your section doing like a little construction building job, and then suddenly you're within the confinements of like an infantry unit, and the next thing you get attacked, and then you're straight away on the defensive, getting the rounds down, doing whatever, you know, you need to do. So it does have its kind of like flip side, whereas like infanteers were very much infanteers, you know, they get into their scraps and stuff like that. But being the engineers unit based where I was in Faubourg-Oulette, mainly in Faubourg-Oulette, we're always out like every day, like doing something, you know, and you've got to be an infanteer first. So we were out on the ground like every day, whereas a lot of the infanteer lads would be, you know, they'd be doing it in, like taking turns, like, so we're going out every second or third day. So we found ourselves like in a lot more scraps and coming onto contacts than any of the sort of like a lot of the units where that we were based with. But yeah, I think doing like the explosive entry side of things, doing sort of night patrols, which is a little bit quite scary. Like, I remember I got attached to PWRR. I think it was when Brian Wood was with them, actually. So that's why.
Who are they?
Prince of Wales Royal Regiment. And I think Brian Wood, MC, was with them then. And I remember I had to teach all their guys how to build a infantry assault bridge, because we basically patrolled all through the night to this crossing point. And then as soon as it hit the crack of dawn, went straight across this big gap using the infantry assault bridge and assaulted this big, I would say big village. It was a little village, obviously. And then I was taking out a lot of the firing points that a lot of the enemy were using with half bar mines and stuff like that, which is pretty cool. You never say no to a bit of bang, which is great. And yeah, that was the majority of that tour, really. Unfortunately, we had incidents where there was people lost and stuff like that. We lost one of our lads in our unit, Bondi. He was the lead vehicle on a bridge recce, top cover. And he actually said on the net, I can see someone crouching down in the bush. And there was a huge explosion, and his vehicle like flipped three times. And the poor lad was shot out of it. And luckily for his parents, he was brought home and he passed away from his head injuries, like, but had his family around him, if you know what I mean. Which was the best thing in a bad situation, I think. And then unfortunately, right at the end of my tour, there was a huge explosion outside this FOB we were staying at, and we got crashed out to it. And it was it was basically five lads from the Yorks, three Yorks, and one lad from the Commandos and the Duke of Lancasters. They were in a warrior vehicle and they went over a huge charge. They reckon it was like over 100 kilos, but it had been known about. So I don't see what happened with the investigations, but they went over it, and I think they were just kind of trying to get used to the grounds because they were taken over. They were just fairly new in theatre. The vehicle exploded, and then there was a lot of horrendous commotion. Took about 10 hours to get into the vehicle because the ammunition was going off in the back. So obviously you couldn't just prise the door open because you didn't know what was going to fly out. And, you know, being an infantry vehicle, you know for a fact they're going to have like UGLs and 7.62, 5.56, everything in there. So the commander, unfortunately, was found about 100 metres away. The young lads in the back were like just unrecognisable. And I think it took about 3 days to officially identify them all before their names were released on the news. It's, you know, it, like a lot of people, it comes with its territories. A lot of people get out of it what they want in terms of soldiering and doing what they joined to do and all that kind of stuff. But then obviously it has its downsides. And I think, but before that tour, I was with a group of lads, and our friend Jonah was killed out in Afghan, and I was stationed in the UK at the time, and his wife, she asked his close friends to bury him rather than have a normal sort of standby burial party do it. So that was a big wake up call for me, actually, because we had to like go and prep. You know, obviously we heard the news, we got told about it, it was devastating. Absolutely gutted. Just, you never think it's going to happen to one of your good mates, like, you know, like while you're not there. We had to go and practice, like doing the you know, carrying them off the plane and all this kind of stuff. And it was like, just the whole build up was like horrible. It was really was. You like you just every day practicing taking a coffin with big boxes of paper to simulate the weight of a body, up and down a down a ramp and then off to the right because that's what you got to do. And you're just doing it again and again and again, and it just becomes part of like your subconscious almost that you know so you know what you're doing, and it's horrible. And then the plane came into Bryce Norton. And we went there and got onto the plane. It was him and his driver that unfortunately were killed in a Jackal. And then I'll tell you what, mate, when that curtain got like pulled back and you see like the coffin, you know, it's got your mate in with the Union Jack on it, man, what a punch in the stomach that is. It's like you kind of lose the feeling in your gut, if you know what I mean. You can just, it's like it's just falling down through your legs. It's like really odd feeling. And then I was front man, my right hand man on that on the coffin, and I remember vividly coming down the ramp off the plane, and then turning right, and then as soon as I turned right, just full front straight in front of me is Mrs. Joe sat right there in front of me, last of like carrying her husband, like it was just it wasn't a nice feeling at all. I kind of obviously acknowledged she was there, but I just had to look up and just stare at the roof of the tent they were sat in. So I didn't keep eye contact with her. And then put him into the hearse. And then I think it was about 3 weeks later that he was that. And obviously then he went through Wootton Bassett. And then we went and buried him 3 weeks later in his hometown in Newport. And even that whole process was horrible. We had to go and dress the coffin the night before, and we went to the local chapel of rest to do it all where he was. And before we walked in, thinking obviously it's just going to be the coffin, and now we had to put the Union Jack on. The guy, the funeral director, was having a bit of a chat with us, and then we walked in, and there he is in his green kit, like all like kind of done up, with the lid off, and we weren't expecting it at all. It was like really weird, and it kind of didn't look like him a bit, you know. He had like really like brushed up, like almost like blow dried hair. And straight away, like in good old fashioned, we were just stood around him, cracked open a bottle of port, was spinning like spinning funny dits about him. And then the cork from the bottle we put on his chest and that, and before we put the lid on. But then we went to put the lid on, and it's got like these little clasps on top of the coffin lid, and the big sort of screws that go through it to lock it into the actual main box weren't long enough. So we were there in like in a funeral parlor, like with him lying there dead, like in his green kit next to us, like not being able to put the lid on. And we ended up like getting like some kitchen butter knife, like taking these clasps off to replace them with new ones. And we're there like next to him, like knocking little nails in on his on the lid to put these different clasps on so we could actually put the actual lid on properly so it would lock. And we were all just like, man, he will be pissing himself. Like, he will be, it's just so weird and surreal. But like that whole experience, I think, like really like hardened my stomach a bit, if you know what I mean, in terms of like the reality of like what actually happens and goes on. And in an instant, a family can lose a loved one and the whole life's turned upside down. Because when I was like, we were lowering him into the ground, I was like literally facing Joanne and his kids. Like, she's there like with her arms around the kids, and I'm like lowering her husband, their dad, into the ground. And it's like, it's a sorrowing experience, it really is. But I genuinely believe that like experiences like that kind of shape me for who I am now. And I've often shared with people, unfortunately, my best friend committed suicide 3 years ago in the sergeant's mess in Tidworth in Wiltshire. And he was a nightmare with alcohol, and he took things too far because he had a fallout with his missus. And it was kind of like an I'll show you type thing. And he hung himself on the back of his door. And I remember, obviously we had to go do his funeral. It was a full military funeral and everything else like that. And I did the eulogy at his funeral. And it was actually, it was generally that point when I had no idea that I wanted to go on to do guest speaking and all this kind of stuff and, you know, motivational stuff to inspire people. I always wanted to do it. I always knew that I could do it. But it was actually at that point when I had like a whole church that was full to the rafters with people like spewing outside and everything, that everyone's eyes were fixed on me to give them some kind of inspiration, some laughter, some like little bit of hope to take them away from that current realization that their loved one had like was not around anymore. And you know, I delivered this, you know, pretty good like eulogy and had everyone wetting themselves, like, and did a good job of it. And I sat down and my missus was just like, man, like, are you not nervous? And I was like, nah, I was just like, it felt right. Do you know what I mean? And you know, I was like, I should do this more often. And by that, I don't mean like stand up people's doing people's eulogies for them. You know, I don't really want to make a habit of that. But that's when I kind of really knew, I was like, right, I need to really do something with this and kind of like package it almost to help the masses, you know. And that's where, that was kind of like the start really of like my actual like proper coaching business, if you know what I mean. And then gone on to do talks and, you know, and stuff like that, really.
How do you peel back a bit? It's a big old thing to put yourself out there, right?
Mm.
You see a lot on social media of these adverts that crop up and it's some guy professing to,
why am I actually having to
change
this?
Your life, or some girl, and they've got a book, right? It's $39.99, but you don't pay postage or printing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was chestnut.
But even still, I always think it's a big old thing to put yourself out there to be able to coach other people, is what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
For myself, AJ, I'm a bit more grassroots. It's more like I've had a bit of shit in my life, right? Which I embrace. I learned some lessons from it, and they kind of help me smile every day, if I was honest, you know.
Even, yeah, of course.
Even on my worst days, I still smile, and there's nothing that I want from life, and there's nothing that life needs to give me. I don't aspire to anything other than, you know, just to keep this happy little bandwagon going along. So I offer people like support from that perspective, right? You know, if you want to come on my Patreon or watch some of my YouTube videos, great. I'll help you where I can. I might do something stupid like run 200 miles over Christmas, and I hope you get something from that, just to see that some of us that were written off probably by a lot of people in society actually are capable of a lot more than the people that wrote us off, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the limit of my, you know. I did a talk recently to a corporation and I just told them the basics, mate, you know, smile at the sun, give appreciation for your life, jog around the block, take a bit of action, this kind of stuff, right? But you seem to be smashing it, which is like, for me, like a different level, you know?
Yeah, and I think the reason why I've kind of made this a success is because I've just been relentless, okay, is the best word to use, I think, in my pursuit for having like the best life possible because of what I've been through in the past, I think, and I've seen life lost, you know, in horrible fashion, through the same as everybody else, you know, for, you know, the loved ones through old age or illnesses and stuff like that. It just gives me, I just have this like endless appreciation for living the best possible life. Obviously, like I didn't go on to mention earlier, but when I finished that Afghan tour, I left the army in 2013 and moved to Australia, as you know, with my family. Had a great life out there, you know. Ended up having my own gym and was coaching, you know, a lot of people out there, but more to do with like strength and conditioning and stuff like that, more so than sort of personal development and business and stuff. But coaching nonetheless, you know, it's a massively transferable skill. And it was the experience of having to come back from the UK because we were so royally screwed over, and we lost everything, you know, like we were spent all our savings just to live over there because of the type of visa we were on. And that's when it was like, well, we need to go back to UK. We have to, we haven't got a choice. So we, you know, come back to UK in end of 2015 with literally the bags on my back, no money. I was actually in debt, and that was 5 years ago. And it's experiences like that, I think, help shape you, because it caused me to be relentless. And I remember I spent about a month trying to work out, like, what do I want to do? Like, now I'm back in UK. I wasn't entitled to anything, like, because I've been out of the country. So the government, like, we couldn't get child benefit. I wasn't entitled to a council house, even as a veteran. Like, I wasn't entitled to a council house, like, nothing, because I hadn't lived in the country for like 3 or 4 months after being back. So we were living at the top of my mom and dad's pub, which was the busiest pub in the whole town. So, my kids were subjected to every night screaming, shouting, swearing, fighting at weekends, just like all that kind of stuff that you get in a bustling British pub. And it massively affected everyone's mental health. And I remember having a breakdown on the side of the road in my little Peugeot 206, because that's all I could afford at the time. And having a serious word with myself, like, saying, like, what the fuck do I do now? Like, this isn't me. I do not, I've got too many strong moral values and everything. I don't belong on my ass. What am I going to do? And that was kind of a bit of a turning point for me, where I was like, right, let's get the fuck out of Dodge and let's do something about it. The only way is up and all the rest of it. So that's when I rejoined the army to get us back on our feet. And, I literally walked straight back in. It was mental. It was like I'd been on holiday. I literally had to do an audio. That was it. I didn't have to do like any tests, like nothing. It was like, here's your green kit. Praise 8 o'clock on Monday. All right, okay. To be fair, I knew a lot of people at the unit anyway, so it wasn't too bad. So
on the same outfit, yeah?
Yeah. But, well, I was actually in UK. Like, my last unit was in Germany, but I ended up joining a regiment in Tidworth in Wiltshire. But I knew a lot of people there anyway, so it was just literally it was a change of scenery, change of faces, really. Just walked straight back in, like, all right, lads. The management had already set the tone, like, for retention by telling everybody that I sold all my businesses in Australia to come back and rejoin the army because I missed it so much.
Said no serviceman ever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it was that period I was in for another 2 years, but I left purely because I've got compartment syndrome in my shins. So I can't like run or like walk fast for even a short amount of time without being in a lot of pain. I was just at a point where it's not really curable to a strong enough percentage to warrant the operation that you need for it.
What actually is it? Because that sounds familiar to me.
Mm. So compartment syndrome is a form of shin splint where the outside muscle on your legs goes like really rock solid because the sheath around the muscle doesn't expand when like blood flows through it. You just end up with like excruciating pain and like you lose a feeling in your feet and all sorts. It's horrible. It's really not nice. And there is an operation to kind of like decompress it, but say that's my leg there. You literally from the knee downwards, you have a scar going like all the way down to your ankle pretty much. And there's only about a 40-50% chance it works. And that's on like young, lean people. And I'm quite a well-built bloke, which, probably didn't help my shins much in the first place, but I didn't have any problems with them when I was out the army. So it was just going straight back in, weight on my back, running around, webbing on, like in boots, all that kind of stuff.
I had that in training towards the end.
That's very common.
Towards like week 24 of our 30 weeks or 32 weeks, I think it was, I started to get this thing where I just this excruciating agony down the outside of my shins. And if I had to describe it, I'd say the muscle was like getting too big for the sheath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because the sheath doesn't expand. That's why.
Yeah. And it was, the corporal ordered me into the RAT vehicle, right? Which is something you never get in a RAT vehicle, right?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't get in it. So I just tagged onto the back of the troop and I kept running. And then when he saw me, he wasn't very happy. He was like, Phil, I told you to get in a wrap vehicle. And I was like, okay, okay. It's the only time in training I got in a wrap vehicle.
It was a similar situation, mate, because we in the army, you call it the jack wagon. And there was a similar situation. Like, so we did this like Christmas cracker green PT thing. And literally within minutes, like I think of the warm up, I was like, wow, my shins are in clip. And it was like a 6 miler, like logs and stretches and all this kind of stuff, you know, like CO's competition. And like I stupidly grizzed it, like, and I spent probably 3 or 4 miles of that not being able to feel my feet, which is, it was probably, you know, and that's the thing as well, in the military, it was just to not show face. I'm a corporal, full screw. I was like, I can't be showing weakness to the guys and stuff like that, you know, and it's just, that mentality is not a good thing. It really isn't, because you can do yourself a lot of damage. And, you know, it's situations like that, which, you know, can, you know, really do people in, and really badly affect their long game, if you know what I mean. So it didn't help me at all. Although, you know, at the time they're like, oh yeah, you really grizzled that, well done, you know, like, God, I can't imagine like how much pain you must have been in. And but then that lasts about a day, and then you're like spending the next week like with legs in shit state.
I got over it because I passed out with my original troop.
Must have been a green berry, mate.
Well, I'm just trying to say something constructive for people that listen that might have experienced what we're talking about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's because people, yeah, it's the same as a lot of injuries, right? So I had 3 slipped discs and loads of nerve damage from an injury in the army. And when it happened, I'm like, oh my God, I didn't go, oh my God, I've got slipped discs. I didn't know. Same with like compartment syndrome, or if on the inside of your legs, where your shin bone is, you can get medial tibial stress syndrome, which is, it almost feels like you've got like a build up of like a ball almost under the bone that just wants to pop out. Yeah, but unless you physically know what the symptoms are and what the, you know, the prognosis is, that you have no, you don't know. So, you know, they are the symptoms of those kind of things, and runners get it. It's a lot more from an outfit point of view, it's a lot more common in the military than anywhere. I think the person who creates something that prevents shin splints in the military is going to be a very well-off person.
Yeah, exactly. Mine went away, I mean, within a week or two. But I remember it. Oh my God, it's like having iron rods down the front of your shins, isn't it? You know, it's really, really painful. I'm honestly not sure how I didn't do any fizz to get over it, you know, like physiotherapy or anything.
From my experience, there's nothing really that physio-wise that can stop you from getting it. It's because, like, you know, you've got the parietal nerve and everything in that muscle as well. So it's just a buildup of like pressure that happens or it doesn't. You know, that's why they say the decompression operation is the only real thing that can stop it. But it's not guaranteed to work. And you can end up with big fuck off scars all down your legs. You know, I wasn't trying to be a leg model or anything, or, you know, or like model swimwear, but like I also didn't want to have like massive scars down my legs.
Can you run now?
Yeah, I can, but I just don't run for long periods of time. Things like playing football and that's not an issue, because it's like short, sharp, you know, little sprints or change of directions and stuff like that. But even after running or after playing football and stuff like that, the legs on the muscles on the outside of my legs, I'll have, you know, a lot of soreness there, just like DOMS, like you would do on any other part of your body if you trained it, you know, for a good 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, got you. AJ, bringing it forward then to your coaching career, because I'm conscious what you can offer people watching.
Lifetime of happiness.
Yeah. I mean, how does it work on, say, an individual basis or a...
I've worked with a lot of people like since I left the military, and I like to base it a lot on mindset, because although, you know, we can be physically fit or, you know, get big into your nutrition and your fitness and stuff like that, we need a strong foundation, like no matter what we're doing, you know, up top, whether that you own a business, whether that you're, you know, corporate, you know, very career minded, whether you know you're a student and stuff like that, that you've got exams coming up. Like, if you need to have a strong mindset to get the best results. So I focus a lot on the mindset of people, and more so towards business and corporates, because people are always trying to take those elements to their next level. And I like working with those type of people. They're like my ideal client, you know, people that have businesses that are trying to improve their brand, the brand awareness, and get better results for their business. And as a result of that, I've actually built my own syllabuses. So like proper structured 4-week, 8-week, 12-week packages that can take people in their businesses, or their brands, or even through their careers, if they're trying to, you know, trying to get to an executive level. You know, it's just trying to get to that next level all the time. And I've business through COVID has been mightily, there's been a massive increase in the demand, purely because it's like it's just like a big sucker punch to everyone. They're like, oh shit, I was doing all right before, and now, like, how do I pivot? You know, is the key word of the year. How do I adapt? Well, you know, any military person will tell you, you know, like, who's spent a decent amount of time in the military, the old cliche, like, you've got to adapt and overcome, haven't you? And that's exactly what people have had to do or need to do during this period. So the syllabuses and the structure and the actual strategies that I've kind of designed help people in these industries massively, through, especially through times like this where they have to adapt. You know, I've worked with a lot of really good small businesses who are very much face-to-face, kind of like had a small venue or and stuff like that, and actually taking their business online. And now they're like, I don't even know if I'm going to go back to face-to-face. I don't know if I want to, because they're actively daily making good turnover because their products are in demand, for example.
I don't want to divert a tangent there, mate, and just say that I've heard this from so many different people now, the way that they've grasped the new changes, which like, I get it. Of course I get it.
Yeah.
You got to make your business work, but it's so sad that grasping these changes doesn't necessarily mean a better way of life.
No, absolutely. I think there's a big difference in that. And I think the key thing that I like to kind of teach people is not just changing your business completely to suit this, I wouldn't say enforced way of life, because your life will still be what you make of it, I think. It's almost creating extra options for their business and extra streams of income, because if 2020 has taught us anything, like, having multiple streams of income is massively important. If you're going to rely solely on your, you know, your wage, which you maybe have a little bit left over at the end of each month, once you paid the bills, you know, looking forward in the future, that's not going to affect your long game at all. You know, you need to adapt, you know, or you need to create solid, sustainable sources of income that are going to consistently give you what you want out of life. Otherwise, you'd just be struggling all the time. And if your business is just about getting over the line each month, again, that's not a way of living life at all for anybody. You know, nobody should have to live like that. It's regardless of what country you live in. I had this conversation with some of the villagers in Sierra Leone, literally on WhatsApp the other day, because they call me like every week, and they're asking how it all is over here during this period, and they ask how my family is and how people are struggling in England, right? You're talking about people that are in like shanty villages are asking about people in England and how they're struggling. So to put it out into perspective, it just goes to show that it doesn't matter, like, whether you're a first world country or you're a country in Africa that's, you know, there's a lot of poverty, unless you're physically bringing money in, and, you know, you're actively, you know, to live in a first world country, you've got to bring money in or have some form of income, because, you know, you've got to pay rent or mortgage. You've got to pay for your means of living, getting by. If you need transportation, if you need this, if you need that, if you can't do any of that to be able to live in a first world country, you know, you might as well be in, like, third world countries, and, you know, living on it, because you just end up living on the streets. And I spent some time speaking to some homeless people in Salisbury over Christmas, and having a good chat with them, and how they ended up the way they ended up. And there doesn't seem that, you know, they don't seem any way out of it. And it's the same for many people around the country. The people that you wrote, you know, amazingly raised money for during Christmas when you did your 200 miler. You know, it's just, so it just goes to show you that the sheer importance of looking forward 6 to 12 months and doing that continuously. I think if you live day to day, if you live in the now all the time, I think things can be quite worrying given like what's going on at the minute.
Yeah, long-term plan. Well, medium-term, long-term, just a goal, isn't it? That,
yes.
I think that it's so central to my life. To be able to keep going forward every day, there's always something that I can do.
Mm-hmm.
To think that for a lot of people, probably in a job, it's like, it's all or nothing, isn't it? You know, it's either work or don't work.
Yeah.
And then fear redundancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly. And this is what I love personally about being a solopreneur, or whatever you want to call it, you know, being a director of my own company, is because I dictate whether I kind of win or lose, really. And I think that's what I love about that. And that's why I love working with business owners, because you know for a fact they want to learn, they want to make their business more successful, or, you know, entrepreneurs that are just starting out, like they want to make something of themselves. And, you know, they're fantastic types of people to work with, you know, kind of driven, and, you know, when you're setting them KPIs and stuff like that, and giving them homework like I do each week, it's they're going to dig deep into doing it because they want to make a success, and they want to implement the strategies that you're showing them because they see them working themselves. So, you know, I say it all the time, like if you want to do well at anything, you need to get yourself around the people that are already doing it, have done it, you know, got the t-shirt, exactly, and learn from these people. Like there's no better like medicine than being around positive, like-minded people that want to see you win, lift you up, help you succeed in life. Because like as soon as you do that, like your life will change tenfold. Like I wholeheartedly can tell you that. Those of you that know me as well, or follow me on social media, we've seen like January last year when I was in Sierra Leone, I was asking people what their big word for 2020 was. And I said that mine was connections, and I stuck to that, to my guns, the whole of 2020. And I tell you what, the opportunities that have come my way and continue to do so and will do 2021 onwards, because I've worked really hard on my connections, is like unreal. Absolutely unreal.
AJ, you've done amazing. Your story is amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Mate, it's been a pleasure. I've been trying to get on for ages.
Well, thank you for being my friend as well, which is...
Oh, you're welcome, man.
You know, that's a big part of this for me. I get to meet lovely people like yourself, and, you know, we have that connection. And you choose your life, don't you? You know, you choose your life, and thank you for being a part of mine.
No, absolutely, mate. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm a big fan of... show a big fan of your work, and as I've said many times, I'm absolutely fascinated by your intellect and your mindset, and the crazy shit that you love to do to help other people. Like it's very commendable.
Yeah, I've been to some depths, you can say, but you know, that's where you find that's where you find diamonds, isn't it?
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
Hey, I made that up.
Yeah.
No, I just love everybody, and I don't want people to suffer unnecessarily. A bit of suffering's okay to learn your shit, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But when you got our brothers and our sisters, you know, committing suicide,
mm-hmm.
you don't need to go that far. I honestly get it, being that depth of despair, but just a little switch in your head, couple of little paradigm changes, it can steer you away from that shit, is what I'm trying to say. So, and yes, AJ, where can people find you?
Well, I'm all over all social platforms. I'm on Instagram, Mr. _ AJ Roberts. Same as on Twitter, Mr. _ AJ Roberts. Facebook, Mr. AJ Roberts. And LinkedIn as well is where I spend a lot of my time. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, connecting with a lot of people on there. I've got my own podcast, the Mr. AJ Roberts Show. Or the AJ Roberts Show, sorry. And my website, if you want to learn more about what I do or even get involved with some of the charity work that I do in Sierra Leone and see about that kind of stuff. So I'm always looking to partner with people and businesses to work on the vision for that. That's MrAJRoberts.com. So I'm pretty active on all of it. Just reach out, connect. You know, like I said, connections. I'm always looking to connect with people.
We'll put all your links below the video, mate. So
amazing, thank you.
Yes, thank you for your friendship, thank you for your support, thank you for your guidance, mate. Absolute brilliant. Cheers, AJ.
Cheers, buddy. Best of luck, everyone, 2021.
Yes, and to everyone watching, if you could like and subscribe, blah 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 blah, much love, friends. Thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share, and don't forget to follow me on social media. Username Chris Thrall. Instagram Chris.Thrall. Thank you.